This is 15 April, and I'm continuing my interview with John Campbell. John, last time we talked a bit about when your time in charge of Hansard, and I had just a couple of questions which I'd like to pursue in that on that line. What sort of a person in charge were you?
Well, I guess I tried to be fair. I don't think I was, well, to use a word, autocratic or unsympathetic. I hope I recognised that I had no formal managerial type training and basically tried to manage the department and the staff according to principles of fairness and equity and justice, those sorts of things, as best I could. Generally, it was a relatively easy department to administer and manage. Last time I think I talked about some of the areas in which I felt were areas of tension, if you like to use that word, which particularly because it was quite different being directly responsible to the presiding officers on a personal level and also to their staffs, whereas in except on occasions when I was acting as a principal parliamentary reporter, I didn't have much direct relationship with the presiding officers. A couple of areas that I don't think I mentioned last time, which are related to this question. One was the responsibility of deciding when people were ready for promotion. As I think I mentioned in the early stage, we tended to have a process of based on seniority. If a person was the next in line in terms of seniority and experience, and that person was qualified for the position, we tended to appoint that person without calling for applications and going through a process of interviews and a process like that, which is quite common in many other areas. So there were a couple of occasions when I decided, largely on a personal basis, but usually with some advice from the more senior officers of the department, not to advance somebody just yet. And that applied particularly to trainee reporters. They of course were always very keen to get through their training period and become reporters and get onto the book, is the expression that we used all the time. And from time to time, it was necessary to decide that trainees were not quite ready yet, and often they were very disappointed with when decisions like that were made. So that was a difficult time. I suppose another area was when people became concerned about the length of time on which they were on duty, felt that the hours were unconscionable in some cases, and tied in with that was the fact that it was nearly always difficult to recruit new staff. If we lost a member of the staff and there wasn't a trainee ready for promotion, it was very difficult to attract somebody with the necessary qualifications and experience from some other reporting staff. There was some tension sometimes when some members of the staff felt that if we weren't able to attract anybody from outside, we should have gone ahead and promoted a trainee. The tension occurred if I didn't think that that trainee was ready for promotion just yet. So that was a source of tension. Those are the main areas in which I feel that I had some difficulties.
Would you consider yourself to be a hands-on manager, or did you delegate?
Well, I tried to delegate wherever I thought that was appropriate, but I certainly regarded myself as a hands-on person. I continued to do quite a bit of supervisor type work, editing. I think I'm right in saying that I always supervised at least one reporter. Wouldn't have had time to supervise more than one, so that I in effect kept my hand in as an editor or a supervisor. And I paid a lot of attention to the to picking up any necessary corrections that needed to be made to the daily Hansard for the publication of the weekly Hansards. So although we had the practice which I've described before of allocating sections of the daily Hansard to each reporter for proofreading, I made a practice of going through the daily Hansards as much as I possibly could to pick up any errors that I thought needed to be corrected. And much of that work I did in my own time. And I always remember my family, particularly my wife, I suppose criticising me for bringing home these daily Hansards nearly every day, and instead of reading a novel or reading some other bedtime reading, I'd be even going to bed and thumbing through a daily Hansard. So I think that's perhaps an indication of the style of hands-on attitude I had.
What was your relationship with your, I suppose you'd have to call them, your two ICs? Particularly Bernie Harris, whom I understand was the last one that you have worked with you. We have a photo in our collection called Last Moments 366, which shows the two of you together. Just wonder if that triggers any thoughts or memories about the way the two of you worked together and what your relationship with him was.
Well, going right back, he had come from Queensland in the same way as I had. He had come from the Queensland State Reporting Bureau working as a court reporter and had come down to Canberra a few years after I did. He is somewhere between 5 and 10 years younger than I am. And he was younger than I was when, at the time of appointment to the reporting staff. I think he was 22, whereas I was 25. Like me, he was single when he came to Canberra and married within a few years and had two young children, whereas we had three. They were younger than our children, but I guess I tried my best to do what Joe McKnight had done for me in welcoming him into Canberra. And I think, in fact, when he first came to Canberra, he actually stayed with us in our house at Watson for a short time before he got himself settled into Canberra. And then we sometimes played golf together, and we played tennis. His was one of the families that I think I mentioned. Came in sometimes on a Sunday afternoon, and we played tennis on the courts, on the, usually on the Senate side. So there was that sort of activity, and although there were three or four reporters appointed between the time of my appointment and his appointment, they were older people, so they, towards the end, of course, they retired. Before he was at the point where he became the assistant principal parliamentary reporter. For instance, his predecessor was a chap called Bob Martin. He was older than both of us. He had come from Adelaide, not from Queensland. And I think I mentioned last time that he actually lived in the same street as us in Watson, so we saw quite a bit of him and his wife. But because we Campbells had much more in common with the Harrises than with the Martins, we saw a lot more of the Harrises than of the Martins. So Bob Martin was assistant principal parliamentary reporter for a couple of years of my 5-year term. And then Bernie Harris came in. Bernie's a very much different character from me. He's a much more outgoing, gregarious person than I am. He's very interested, and has been for years very interested in the media, and he's got very wide experience in the media. Apart from being a Hansard reporter, he in his earlier years he wrote scripts for television. For many years he was a commentator for the ABC on soccer matches here in Canberra, and had a very keen interest in lots of things to do with the media. He also associated with members and senators much more than I did, although I did lots of committee work where we spent lots of time away from Canberra with members and senators on committees. He probably did more of that than I did eventually, and he established quite close relationships with lots of members and senators, many more than I did. We didn't always see eye to eye on some things, and one of the problem areas was that he did not get on well with a couple of the fairly senior officers of the department who were in positions only a little way down the line from him, where I was on much better terms with them than he was. And this is a very difficult area to talk about, but an example of that, and in many other people might not think this is a very serious matter, but it's something that clearly sticks in my mind. For many years, it was the practice for the senior group of officers who were here in the office much more frequently and for much longer hours than the more junior officers to get together for morning tea. We'd come down to the refreshment rooms. I don't know when this practice actually started, but it goes back a long way to people such as Bill Bridgman and Ken Ingram. As I say, just a small group of four, perhaps five at the most, would have this practice of just getting together nearly every morning tea for morning tea. Now, in my time, that became impossible because three of the, say, five most senior officers, the PPR, the APPR, and the three leaders of staff, did not get on well together. And there was a lot of tension between two of those leaders of staff on the one hand and the APPR. So another area that's difficult to talk about is that Bernie is very good at public speaking and telling stories about things that happened, and some people might not always agree with his versions of events. Now, I don't want to go into this at any length, but I was shown recently a copy of an article that appeared in the Canberra Times Public Informant supplement, I think it's called. And there are some stories in that article related by Bernie. And just as a couple of instances, my recollection of things does not agree with some of his recollections. I might just take a couple of instances, and as I say, this is something on which there could well be differences of opinion and in which my recollection may not be as accurate as I think it is. For instance, in that article, there are a couple of quotes of strange things that have either appeared in Hansard or have occurred in the house and may not have got into Hansard. Just a couple that I'll pick out. There's a reference there which says, "Did honourable members really have their trouts in the snoff, or had Dr. Spooner struck again?" Well, my recollection of that Spoonerism was that it read snoffs in the trout, not trouts in the snoff. And then there's another example where there's a little story about a tired and emotional senator who was having the devil's own job trying to get the title of the person occupying the chair correct. And it finished up with the occupant of the chair at that time saying, according to Bernie's recollection, in effect, the correct title is, quote, "the acting deputy president. I don't have sex when I am in the chair." Now, my recollection of that incident is that it was not a senator who was in any way inclined to be tired and emotional, really at any time, and that it was just a case of getting a little bit tongue-tied and not remembering the exact way to refer to the occupant of the chair. And my recollection is that the person in the chair, who of course was a woman, said it is the acting deputy president, I don't have any sex when I am in this position. So I don't want to go through that article in detail, but I just give those as a couple of instances where my recollection differs from his. And, well, I guess I'm actually implying that sometimes Bernie's recollections and the stories that he told may not have been strictly accurate. But that's just my recollection and my understanding of these sorts of things. So there were times when there were tensions between him and me, largely for those sorts of reasons. But I suppose the principal one was that, well, there was another incident that comes to mind when I suppose was one of the few really difficult staff issues that I had to deal with as PPR. And that was one evening when one of the attendants had been down to dinner and had just a little bit too much to drink over dinner and got into an argument with the chief attendant. And they actually came to blows in the office. And that was a matter that I had to deal with. I tried to smooth it all over and to counsel the more junior attendant about his duties, and I felt that the matter could be resolved by that way, by just a little bit of counselling and a little bit of common sense. On the other hand, Bernie's attitude was that the more junior officer had overstepped the mark, and he sided with the chief attendant, and my recollection is that both of them were pushing for more severe action to be taken against the junior attendant. So that was an instance I remember where we were in disagreement.
Did you find it difficult to work with him were there matters that you didn't trust him to deal with the way you wanted at times?
No, I think anything that I wanted him to deal with, I could hand over to him and trust him to deal with it appropriately, and particularly in any areas where he had more expertise and experience than I did. And the obvious area of that was initially the tape recording work, the work of the technical officers, not the attendants, the technical officers. And it came to a head when there was a proposal to establish what became known as the Sound and Vision Office. And that was an area in which he would have been very competent and very suitable to be in charge of that. We endeavoured, and I had a fairly prominent part to play in this, we endeavoured to get the presiding officer's agreement to put the Sound and Vision Office under the Department of the Parliamentary Reporting Staff. And we thought we had a good chance of getting that under Speaker Harry Jenkins, Senior. But the presiding officers decided that they would refer the matter to the Committee on the Broadcasting of Proceedings, and that meant a committee inquiry at which I represented the department and gave evidence or presented a submission arguing that the office should be put under our department. And that did not happen. Bernie Harris did not get a position where he was in charge of the Sound and Vision office. And eventually a section called the Parliamentary Information Systems Office, PISO, was established, and it was put under the control of the library, not under our department. My recollection is that that really wasn't resolved by the time I left in March 1990. And what happened after that was that following my retirement, a new principal parliamentary reporter was appointed from the Prime Minister's department, in effect from outside the parliament. And then when a short time later the parliamentary librarian retired, no appointment was made to that position substantively, and the principal parliamentary reporter was also appointed acting parliamentary librarian. And that really was the beginning of the amalgamation of the three service departments.
The article that you referred to, that Bernie Harris had written, implies that he was principal parliamentary reporter from 1990 to 1999.
He was never principal parliamentary reporter. A chap called John Templeton took the position after I retired, and Bernie's title was Chief Hansard Reporter under the Principal Parliamentary Reporter. As I say, he had responsibility for Hansard and the library from the early 1990s. So Bernie's title was Chief Hansard Reporter.
Okay. Have we anything else you want to add on the matters we've covered on in relation to the work environment at this point? Or shall we move on to another topic?
I think that's covered things reasonably well.
Okay, well, I'd like to go on to something a bit different and go back to the beginning. Were you interested in politics before you came to Canberra, or did you become interested in a sense, the political side of things through working here?
I guess I was interested in it right from the time I started work, because, as I explained, I started work in Parliament House in Brisbane, and in fact, I started there in January 1951, not 1950, as I said right back at the beginning of these interviews. I made a mistake in referring to it as 1950. It was 1951. Our offices, the offices of the State Reporting Bureau, were on an upper level of Parliament House, which of course was the same level as the galleries of the Legislative Assembly Chamber. The public galleries, the press gallery, and the Hansard Gallery were all within spitting distance, virtually, of our offices. So one of the ways in which we trainee reporters built up our shorthand speed was by going into the gallery, the public gallery, and practicing on the actual proceedings in the Legislative Assembly, as well as, of course, the more formal training that we did, particularly at the business college, where we did formal shorthand tests and practice. And even that, much of that practice material was taken out of Hansard reports. So, in effect, right from the word go, I was associated with and involved in that peripheral way with politics. And then when I did my those tertiary studies that I referred to in the first interview, I first of all did accounting, but then when I decided to go on with that to do try to do a commerce degree, as well as economics and statistics, I did 2 years of political science. The first year was about Australian politics and British politics, and the second was about United States and Russian politics. I'm not sure that I actually finished Political Science 2, as it was called, because I finished up with only 8 units, which gave me the diploma rather than the 12 I would have needed to complete a commerce degree. So I was involved in politics at work, and I was doing a little bit of it in my external studies with the University of Queensland at that stage. And of course, because the Hansard reporters and the court reporters were in the same department, the State Reporting Bureau, we were often in contact with those half a dozen Hansard reporters, and often talking to them about what was going on in the parliament, even in the time when I was working as a court reporter and not as a Hansard reporter.
Did you ever join a political party?
No, I've never been a member of a political party.
Well, as you know, we've got a major new development on the way here at Old Parliament House, the Gallery of Australian Democracy. The word democracy, that's is one which has means different things to different people, and I think also in different countries. What does the word democracy and the term democracy mean to you?
Well, you gave me warning of this question, so I've prepared a couple of little notes. I'll just use these notes as a basis for my response to that question. My understanding of democracy is that it involves the people of a country having appropriate opportunities to participate in the government and the administration of their country. And this, in my view, should involve such things as free and fair elections, including appropriate representative voting systems, that there be free speech and associated with that freedom of the press, that it involves government being responsible and accountable to the parliament, the members who've been elected by the people to represent them in parliament. It involves an apolitical public service that's encouraged to give for the government frank and fearless advice, to use the quite common expression, and that it should involve high standards in the making of appointments to significant positions, such as Governors General, judges, departmental heads, members of government agencies, and so on. But I think it should also involve appropriate levels of assistance to non-government members of the parliament, that is, the government backbenchers, and especially opposition members. And I think the Commonwealth Australian Parliament is a classic example of very successful attempts to provide that sort of assistance through our parliamentary library, which I think is renowned around the world as being a great resource centre for government backbenchers and especially opposition members. And desirably, it should involve a comprehensive and appropriately resourced parliamentary committee system. So those are just some of the principles that I thought were involved in democracy.
And do you think this country meets those standards that you lay down there at this point in time?
I think it does. I think Australia is one of the outstanding examples of democratic system of government in the world. And I think we're exceedingly fortunate to live in a country that has such a high standard of adoption of democratic principles.
The years that you worked in Parliament, you would have experienced the House in action, both chambers in action, under seven prime ministers: Menzies, Holt, Gorton, McMahon, Whitlam, Fraser, and Hawke. Now, taking them one at a time, what was your impression of them as individuals and as parliamentary operators?
Okay, when I came in 1960, of course, Sir Robert Menzies was Prime Minister, and there until 66. Obviously, in my view anyway, he was in the twilight of his career, and he had the reputation of being a great orator. And a great parliamentary performer, and also a very successful and competent performer on the hustings. My recollection is that in the early 60s he was still a dominant personality, I suppose you could say a towering presence whenever he came into the chamber from that little alcove in the corner and came down to the centre table. The House just seemed to change with Menzies' entry into the chamber.
In which way when you say change, in which way do you mean?
Well, change in the sense that the attention even of the members would tend to be directed towards him, although he might not be doing anything, merely coming in and sitting at the table. His mere presence there seemed to have a calming effect that other members, or most of them anyway, would tend to feel that they need to be a bit more respectful and more dignified, because he certainly was a man of dignity and presence. For those 5 or 6 years after I came, he wasn't making his traditional speeches. Most of the speeches that he made were prepared and read speeches rather than extempore speeches in which he would be responding to interjections, and for which he had a great reputation, an ability to respond with humour and with appropriateness to all sorts of interjections. So mostly his speeches in my time were prepared and read speeches, but of course he was there to respond to questions at question time. But for much of the time, question time, which certainly was not televised, and was, on the other hand, was broadcast on Tuesdays and Thursdays from the House of Reps, it wasn't as lengthy. The ministers, and certainly my recollection is Menzies, didn't use question time as a great opportunity to go into a great length about government policies, or to try to use Dorothy Dick's questions to make great speeches criticising the opposition, and on the other hand praising all the things that the government was doing. That my recollection is that that wasn't the way things were done in Menzies' time. So he goes down as one of the great Australian Prime Ministers, of course, and to a large extent some of the criticisms of him related to his experience before and during the Second World War rather than in the post-war years. I guess the significant things in his time in the 60s, apart from his retirement in 66, the other one was the 1961 election, where he only scraped back in and had a majority of only one after providing the speaker, if my recollection is accurate. But he was able to turn that around in the next election, which I think was in 63. And of course, the other factor that's much to his credit, but it's obviously before my time, was the formation of the Liberal Party. So he was one of the great figures across all my time, but especially in those first 6 years.
Were there any sort of standout moments in relation during the time that he was still Prime Minister while you were in the chamber? Any moments that you can remember specifically where you happened to be present?
No, I don't remember any incidents in which I was involved as a reporter, or which really stand out. There are just a couple of little things which have been well reported and well recorded in various historical books and biographies and so on.
None that I was involved in.
Right. No.
Okay, well then the next one coming up then is Harold Holt. What was your impression of him?
My impression of Holt was that he was 2IC to Menzies, and obviously his preferred successor. He'd been groomed to take over. Again, it's a personal impression, but I got the impression that to some extent the job of criticising the opposition and being the government's chief attacker of the opposition was a job that was seen to be beneath the dignity of the Prime Minister and should be handed over to the TYC. So Holt was often in that position of being the chief attacker of the opposition. But he was such a gentlemanly fellow that in public appearances anyway, that he wasn't always very effective in that role, it seemed to me. For most of that time he was treasurer. I think for all of that time, because he succeeded Fadden, if I'm not mistaken. And really, I didn't have anything to do with him personally, and it was just a matter of reporting his speeches whenever I was in the reps.
Did he strike you as being a good parliamentary operator?
Yes, because he was the leader of the House, and of course that involved negotiating with Gough Whitlam, who was had that job on behalf of the opposition, and obviously they were able to get on reasonably well, and Holt generally was able to manage the government's business and do what was necessary to get the government's business through the House. I think he was a quite competent parliamentarian.
Hmm. Any standout memories of him, again, in the chamber?
No, I don't have anything in particular about Harold Holt.
Hmm. Well, then, followed John Gorton.
Our relationship with John Gorton and his office was unique in my experience because my understanding is that an instruction that we in Hansard were given probably came from Ainsley Gotto and probably did not come from John Gorton himself. But we were instructed to report John Gorton verbatim. In my experience, that request, or certainly not an instruction, didn't ever come in respect of any other member or senator. And so, although Gorton was highly educated and a quite reasonable speaker, when we reported him verbatim, his speeches did not come out as well as many other members' speeches did. And, for instance, in the 1969 election, if I remember rightly, Gough Whitlam was able to use quotes from Hansard of Gorton's speeches to great effect, or in effect ridiculing the language that Gorton was recorded as in Hansard as using. So that was probably the most direct relationship we in Hansard had with Gorton, and of course he was quite different from most other conservative political leaders, in that he was on the conservative side. Political leaders on the conservative side, because he proposed some quite unusual policies for the Liberal Party, and certainly he wasn't as strong on states' rights, for instance, as most other Liberal Party and Country Party leaders were. He was, the word that's often been applied to him is a larrikin. He was nowhere near as straight-laced as Holt or Menzies, for instance, or McMahon.
Did that actually show itself or show up in the way he acted in while he was in the chamber as well? Did he?
No, not to my recollection.
Hmm.
It seemed to me the way in which it showed up most prominently was in the events that led eventually to his downfall. But of course they were largely events outside the parliament, and my recollection is that he always conducted himself most appropriately in the parliament, and he wasn't a difficult speaker to report in any sense, and I suppose in many ways it's easier to report a speaker verbatim than it is to present a rational verbatim report. So to that extent he didn't present any great difficulties for a Hansard reporter, except for the fact that he was a highly educated man, and but that didn't mean that he used language that was difficult to report.
Was Hansard ever given any explanation as to why Gorton wanted Gorton's speeches were to be reported verbatim?
Not to my knowledge. Again, this is a very personal opinion. I just believe that Ainsley Goddow thought Gorton was the be-all and end-all, a person who was almost perfect and would never make any mistakes, and he was the perfect speaker and didn't need any attention by people as lowly as Hansard reporters.
And how did Hansard staff take this? Did you find it difficult to sort of to comply with that, or were there any discussions or objections to it? Or
No, not to my knowledge. We just accepted it as an instruction that had come from the Prime Minister's office. It was easier to do that, to give a verbatim report rather than to do the work of editing it to make it a rational verbatim report. That's my recollection of the main thing that affected Hansard in John Gorton's time, but of course there were the momentous events during his prime ministership.
McMahon.
Well, McMahon as prime minister wasn't there for very long, but I suppose the thing which sticks in my mind relates to his earlier career, but still in my time, when he was treasurer and before that Minister for Labour and National Service. And again, a highly educated man, a lawyer and an economist, I think, had double degrees. And a very experienced politician, but the thing related to Hansard was that it was not uncommon for McMahon at question time to, off the top of his head, give detailed figures about the number of people unemployed or all sorts of economic statistics. And then our Hansard transcripts would be submitted to his office, and quite often those figures on unemployment or economic statistics would be corrected by his staff. And again, although the definition of what members and senators were allowed to do was to make necessary corrections, almost invariably those changes would be regarded as necessary corrections. They, I suppose, it reflected the fact that they were corrections of actual figures, figures which had been quoted wrongly. Other people might say that what he was supposed to be doing was only correcting only any errors that had been made by the Hansard staff. But in terms of an historical record, it was providing accurate figures. And as I say, in unless another member made a point of drawing attention to figures being inaccurate, those corrections by his office would have been accepted and would have finished up in the Daily Hansard, and certainly in the Weekly Hansard.
So this was not seen as I suppose in a sense a breach of Hansard role, that numbers might have been substantially changed or modified by the members, him or herself?
No, because there were many other members who made a practice of making quite substantial changes to their speeches, and generally speaking, those changes would be accepted. But, those ones in the case of McMahon tended to be numerical changes, whereas most of the others were literary changes, perhaps a different choice of words or a different sentence construction or something like that. There were some members who regretted the fact that they had not put things the way they wanted to when they were on their feet in the chamber, and wanted to take the opportunity to make editorial changes to their speeches. And some members had a particular style that they wanted to preserve, and we might, as Hansard reporters, might not have been always familiar with that particular style that they wanted. I can think of a few examples. They don't relate to prime ministers, but just to go back a little bit, my recollection is that it would have been most unusual for anything to come back from Sir Robert Menzies' office with any changes at all. Menzies was, in my recollection, perfectly happy to accept whatever the Hansard staff reported him as saying. On the other hand, I can remember Paul Hasluck, who was, again, a very well-educated, very articulate, very distinguished person in all sorts of fields, as well as politician, and was, I suppose the best word to describe him was a pedant. Had a